This is KUOW's The Record. I'm glad you've tuned in today. I'm Bill Radke. Heroin use is such a big problem in the Puget Sound area. People use in parks, alleys, public bathrooms. Today, King County convened a task force to come up with solutions, and their report is out today. The report calls for the creation of safe consumption sites, one in Seattle, another in King County, where people can use illegal drugs under supervised medical care. The only other place this is happening in North America is Vancouver, BC. Their safe injection site is on Vancouver's downtown east side. A CNN documentary shows users bringing their own heroin and cocaine into the building known as Insight. They sit down at one of 12 metal booths and shoot up.
There are nurses on site to revive users who stop breathing and even help them choose the safest vein. Many addicts stop by several times a day to shoot up. Steve Adams is trying to reduce his addiction. For Steve, Insight is his best hope of regaining the life he once had.
Since I've been coming down, I've been weaning off the dope. I really want to get off of it. I don't want to die in the process trying to get off of it. You know, and that's why these places, it's common sense, really.
Long-term addicts like 48-year-old Steve use to stave off what is known as dope sickness or withdrawal. The symptoms can be brutal and swift. Nausea, vomiting, and stomach pains, striking in as little as 6 hours between injections, lasting for up to 10 days. A hit of heroin brings no pleasure after 30 years of using.
Basically, I do heroin, right? And what I do each day, I take a shot so I'm not sick. There's no buzz, there's no fun in it anymore.
A shot so I'm not sick, no buzz, no fun. That is a visit to the safe injection site in Vancouver, BC. Again, a King County task force today called for two safe consumption sites here. Task force member Caleb Banta Green told KUOW's Kim Malcolm why he thinks government-sanctioned sites for drug users are a good idea.
The goal is to keep people alive, that if they hopefully won't have an overdose, if they do have an overdose, it will be observed and can be reversed before it's fatal. And also to prevent infectious disease transmission, as well as to also move use into a safer place where people can actually, if they are injecting into a vein, actually inject into that vein and not cause an abscess or an infection, and also not to use in public.
You know, some people may support the concept of consumption sites, but they don't want it in their backyard. What would you say to them?
People use drugs. A lot of people use drugs. People have used drugs for thousands of years. And that if you have people using drugs in your community, I would argue it's going to be better for you and your community that they have a safe place to use. They are already there. It's the same thing also with syringe exchange sites and with drug treatment sites. If people in your community are already using, you have a choice. Do you want them to continue using and using in public, or do you want them to be using in a safer environment inside where they also can potentially hook up with other medical and treatment services? They're there. They're using. What do you want to do about it?
One of the key recommendations from the task force involves expanding access to treatment services. What's the plan to do that?
We are really trying to increase access to a medication called buprenorphine. It's really one of the gold standard medications for people who have opiate use disorder. It keeps people from going into withdrawal. It helps them feel normal, and it reduces mortality rates by 50%.
50%?
By 50%. And the model we're calling Bup First, and the idea is it's buprenorphine first, that we want to get people on this medication within a couple of days of them wanting it and getting them on it for a protracted period of stabilization for 30 to 60 days where we're really making minimal other requirements of them. So often drug treatment involves lots of counseling, lots of visits, medical visits, monitoring, urinalysis. Those are ideal. We've let the ideal get in the way of good enough. And the good enough is really keeping people alive and getting them stabilized. And so we think this buprenorphine first model is a way to do that really out in the community and hopefully get hundreds and eventually thousands and more people stabilized on these medications and able to function well.
Have you seen it work well in other cities?
So San Francisco is the one other city I'm aware of that has this model. They've enrolled 1,300 people in this model, and they've really felt like they've had really good successes with that. And this is really, first and foremost, a humane model where we're trying to meet the needs of the person who has opioid use disorder first, and worry about the financial and medical systems secondarily. Those tend to trump and get in the way of getting the right care to people at the right time.
Another piece of the puzzle here is the medication naloxone, which can reverse the effects of an overdose. What is the task force recommending?
So the recommendations are focused on getting naloxone into the hands of opiate users and their friends and family who are likely to witness an overdose. That's the primary focus. Last year, the King County Needle Exchange survey, only about half of heroin users actually had naloxone. So we really need to get that up to as close to 100% as we can.
And how would you go about doing that?
So that is basically going to be a matter of fairly modest funding and just removing any sort of barriers to just make it really quick and easy to get that naloxone into the hands of heroin users.
Another big part of your recommendations involves prevention. What do you think King County should be doing that it isn't doing right now?
What we know is that we really want to stop adolescents from experimenting with prescription opiates. So everything's really about that. We know from research that the peak age at which people first misuse opiates is 14, 15. So we're trying to hone in on that. And we also have really nice data from the Washington State Healthy Youth Survey that has shown over the last decade, as prescribing of opiates has come down some, that high schoolers' use of prescription opiates to get high has dropped in half. So we know that limiting access to adolescents in terms of misuse will really decrease future substance use disorders. So what we're trying to do specifically is really piggyback on a model that's rolling out over the coming months, which is a secure medication return, which is going to be putting drop boxes in dozens of pharmacies across King County where people can dispose of their controlled substances. That's not quite live yet. That'll be coming in the next few months. So we really want to make sure that people know about those medication drop boxes and also understand why they should be using them.
Caleb, you've talked to us before about heroin and opioid addiction. It is a big, complicated problem here in King County. How hopeful are you that these recommendations and policy changes that you're discussing are going to have a real impact?
These are the right things. I mean, if we do these things, we will have a meaningful impact on reducing mortality in our community and improving the quality of life. But we'll need to do really all of these things, and we'll need to implement them in a really quite substantial manner. Again, we have thousands of people with opioid use disorder in our community, and it is a debilitating condition. It really creates chaos in their life and in other people's lives and also in our community more generally. You know, isolating this all in one little locale is where a minority of people are is not going to have a big impact. This is happening across our county, and these interventions have to also happen across our county.
Talking with KUOW's Kim Malcolm, that's Caleb Banta-Green, a senior researcher at the University of Washington's Alcohol and Drug Abuse Institute and a member of a King County task force that today called for two safe consumption sites, one in Seattle, another outside it in the county, where people can use illegal drugs under supervised medical care. We'll continue to follow how much support that idea gets right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The Seattle Mariners are on a late-season win streak.
Martin Marte. It's going to be Marte. And the Mariners win it 2-1. Eight consecutive wins. A 6-0 road trip. They've won 10 of the last 13, and they pick up ground in the wild card chase.
Yes, the Mariners are only a game and a half behind in that wild card chase. The way it's going, it looks like Seattle will miss the playoffs. That's according to the 538 blog, which is known for its stat crunching and accurate predictions. Today, the 538 blog gives the Mariners only a 1-in-3 chance at the playoffs. But their quest to defy those odds continues tomorrow night against the Astros in Seattle. This week, Mexico is celebrating Independence Day, which is a big holiday for Mexicans on both sides of the border, and a busy time for one Seattle area band. As part of her series Art of Our City, KUOW's Marcy Silman introduces us to Banda Vagos.
It's a scorching Saturday afternoon, but the heat doesn't bother the crowd or the musicians who play traditional Mexican music called banda.
It's a genre of music that actually originates in Germany. It was brought by German-Austrian soldiers in the early 1900s that were stationed down in Texas and northern Mexico.
Trumpeter Cesar Amaral grew up in a musical home. Amaral's father, Roberto, played with a Mexican pop band before he moved to Seattle in 1988.
There was always like instruments around the house. There was always a drum set somewhere because he's a drummer. I started playing the trumpet. My brother, Roberto Jr., he started playing the saxophone.
But they didn't play banda music until Cesar went on a high school band trip to Mazatlan.
I would notice that the musicians from the jazz band, they would go to the market, the mercado, and they would buy these CDs with these big groups of 20 people, right? And they would buy the music because they'd see sousaphones and clarinets and trumpets, and they loved the music.
Cesar figured Seattle area Mexicans might love it too, so he and his family formed Banda Vagos. That was 16 years ago. More than 50,000 native-born Mexicans now live in King County. Cesar Amaral says they've left their homelands behind, but not their cultural ties.
This music is nostalgic for them. And we've literally seen old men crying when we walk in playing this music because it brings back their memories, right, of when they were kids or when they were at their rancho or where they were in their pueblo.
On this summer afternoon, mothers dance with toddlers. Older couples hold hands and tap their toes to the lively music. Enticing aromas from a taco truck float on the warm breeze. It's a little bit of Mexico on the shores of the Duwamish River. From South Park, that's the art of our city. I'm Marcy Silman.
You can find all of the stories in Marcy's Art of Our City series on social media and at our website, KUOW.org. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bill Radke. We just got the list of National Book Award nominees for fiction today, and on that list is a novel called The Underground Railroad. It's the story of a young Georgia slave and her escape. In this book, the Underground Railroad is depicted as an actual physical railroad with trains and conductors and engineers. The author, Colson Whitehead, told me why he decided to make it real.
Well, I mean, I had the idea 16 years ago, just thinking about that first time you hear about the Underground Railroad, and at least me, I know other people too, envision a literal network of tracks beneath the earth, a literal subway, and, you know, how fantastic that is. And it seemed, you know, what if that was actually true? And
that's what you saw as a child in your mind?
Yeah, briefly. And then your teacher is like, no, it's actually some, you know, more of a social network of people. But, you know, just that image stayed with me, and it seemed might be interesting to pursue this sort of, you know, absurd what-if question.
Yeah, what did that do for you, having an actual railroad with you know, stations and trains? What did that device do for you?
Well, yeah, there's just one more complicating thing about it is that sort of like in Gulliver's Travels, where Gulliver roams the seven seas and finds different islands that attack different facets of British culture and politics. Cora, our protagonist, is as she runs north, is going through different states of American possibility. South Carolina has its own sort of political culture, and North Carolina has its own culture. So by playing with history and moving things around in time, it allowed me not to just talk about slavery, but different aspects of American history, the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, various eugenics movements, the Great Society programs of the 1960s. When Cora goes to South Carolina, she's given a job and housing and education, which obviously didn't happen in 1850, but it allows me to sort of broaden the conversation about race in America.
You've made a connection between your hellish vision of North Carolina, where if you have dark skin, you can just be executed, a connection between that and what happened in some places here in the Pacific Northwest.
In my book, North Carolina, as opposed to the real North Carolina, is a white supremacist state with echoes of Nazi Germany and also Oregon. Oregon, because of this fear of a rising black nation, was founded on white separatist principles, and African Americans weren't allowed to reside in Oregon for many years. So I'm tweaking things that have actually happened, pushing history in order to see, you know, different paths we might have gone down as a nation.
It's dangerous to ask a writer about literal parallels, I realize, but you must have in mind the kind of conversations we're having today around Black Lives Matter and police brutality. Are you commenting? What do you want to say to us?
Well, you know, when you talk about the past, you're often talking about the present. You know, that's how we got here. And there are definitely parallels to be made between police brutality now and stop and frisk policing policies and slave patrollers 150 years ago. Before there was a police force in the Deep South, the people who maintained order were slave patrollers, and they could go – they would roam the plantations, roam the streets, go into any free black person's house and demand to see their papers because you had to have your ID and proper license to walk around. And if you didn't have your papers, you could be beaten. If you ran away, you could be shot. And the penalty for running away when the cotton industry was in boom in Georgia and Florida was death. And so it's not hard to push, you know, some of the more obscene acts of police brutality now and see their origin in slave patrol policies 150 years ago.
Do you feel like you're in a conversation with something like 12 Years a Slave, your, you know, fictional commentary and something as literal and direct and visual as that movie?
Well, you know, that movie was based on a slave narrative, and that's, you know, that was the source of most of my research. About a third of the way when I was writing The Underground Railroad, I did watch 12 Years a Slave and had to stop after an hour. It was one thing to be engaged with, you know, the true reality of slavery and the extent of the brutality and put my characters through it and deal with it on the page every day. But actually seeing human actors being brutalized was too much. I couldn't see a human face put to all the stuff that I was putting down the page. So maybe one day I'll go back to the movie, but I need a little breathing room.
Yeah, I wondered what that must have been like for the actors and for the writer, John Ridley. And I wondered that about you, too, both of you African-American, what it was like for you to put your characters through that and put yourself through that.
Well, I think you have to be engaged with the material in order to make that empathic act of imagination, which is animating characters. But you also need distance to shape the material in an artistic way. Make sure what you want to get out there is getting on the page. So you're simultaneously in the story and out of it. And I think at least that's how I work. So on the one hand, you're dealing with the material with your heart, another also with your brain separately, and finding a balance, I think, at least for me, was important.
I wonder what you make of current events. Are you following things like Georgetown University apologizing for its role in slavery and, you know, giving admissions preference to the descendants of slaves? At the University of Washington, some students of color want the George Washington statue on campus to have a plaque, including the fact that he owned slaves. There's this talk on college campuses and elsewhere about being more real.
It's hard to talk about slavery. I mean, I think if you're your family grew up in the South and your great-great-great-great-grandfather and grandmother had slaves, it's hard to contemplate how they treated them and the fact that they brutalized and assaulted them and kept them as objects. And if you're an African American and spent generations striving and entering into the American dream, it can be hard to contemplate how your ancestors were treated, the nameless ones who lived and died on the plantation in that misery. You know, definitely for me, growing up in elementary school, I think we'd learn about slavery and then learn about Lincoln in, you know, 1.5 hour. And that was the extent of the discussion about slavery. And then you talk about separate but equal and Brown versus the Board of Education. And then suddenly Martin Luther King comes and civil rights abuses are over. It doesn't work that way. And definitely, hopefully, schools are spending longer units on, you know, the true history of the country.
Colson Whitehead, author of the novel the Underground Railroad. He's going to be in Seattle at the downtown branch of Seattle Public Library this Saturday talking about his book. Today, Whitehead was nominated for a National Book Award in Fiction. Later today, we're going to be talking about the part that slavery might have played in the story of Jack Daniels. The official story is that Jack Daniel learned how to make whiskey from a preacher. But 150 years later, the company is highlighting the contributions of a former slave. We'll tell you about that this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. The record here on KUOW Seattle, mental health is not a common topic of conversation among middle schoolers. Radioactive's Natalie Newcomb shares the story of how that silence caused a girl's depression to go to an extreme.
I love my friend Sam's bright smile, and she always makes me laugh. Sam and I are looking through her yearbook from middle school.
There I am. That picture's not bad.
That's actually a really good picture.
Yeah.
In middle school, Sam struggled. We won't be using her last name because the story contains information regarding her mental health. In seventh grade, she was trying to figure out her role in the social ladder, and her parents were fighting, and she was feeling extremely sad.
I started being like, oh, well, I can't talk about these things. Like, let's just bottle them up. Like, you're basically taught to bottle up your feelings in middle school.
She kept her feelings from her parents, too.
With my parents, they just really don't like to talk about it.
And at the time, Sam's school hadn't discussed mental health.
There was no talk about anything bad, like any issues. Mental health is seen as like a bad thing.
She learned from a friend that there was a counselor at school who she could talk to about her problems. After talking, her counselor said,
I don't want to diagnose you, but I think that you might have depression.
And the counselor called her father, Randy. Her father said, he felt sad.
I think all parents want to have the perfect child. I think that all parents want to fix the child. And so I was bummed out about it. But I was supportive, I think.
Yeah. Mostly, yeah.
Mostly.
Yeah.
Sam continued counseling and went to a doctor and got a common antidepressant, Prozac. But her home life became worse.
My parents were like, you gave my child depression, or you gave my child depression. Like, they would use me as topics of argument now.
Her parents got divorced after years of fighting.
Like, their divorce kind of was actually, like, kind of a breath of fresh air. Like, I'm like, okay, like, they're not forced to live with each other anymore and stuff like that.
She now lives with her dad. After being on Prozac for a few months, Sam's doctor decided to take her off. The FDA warns that the drug could increase suicidal thoughts and behaviors. But Sam wanted to continue, but didn't speak up. She thought her opinion would be overlooked.
It's like I really had no real decision in the matter. I really didn't. It got worse since I was off medication.
Once off medication, Sam didn't know how to cope with her emotions. She heard that other girls she knew cut to cope with their depression, and she tried it. Sam was cutting for about 2 months. She knew she had to stop, and she managed to force herself to stop. She was afraid her emotions would not be taken seriously.
I'm like, okay, what do I need to do? I'm like, okay, well, I'm having urges. I'm thinking about killing myself. And like, I need people to help me.
Sam took a desperate step for help. She went to the school bathroom and cut her wrists, bandaged her cuts with a tampon, and walked down the hall to her school counselor to show her. It was a half-assed suicide attempt. It was a, I want to die, but if I could get help, that would be awesome kind of deal. The school called her father, and he picked her up.
But he was extremely pissed off. The entire time, he was extremely pissed off that I had done that. To me, it felt like it was such a big inconvenience, and like, this was such a burden on him and stuff, which made me feel even worse. I guess I expected people to, again, take me seriously. I was met with opposite reaction of, oh my God, like, you're an absolute idiot.
And I was angry.
This is Sam's dad again, and they sat down to talk about it.
The reason I was angry is probably not what you would think. I was angry that I was blindsided and that I thought we were closer than that, and that we would have communicated how bad of a place you were in mentally.
Really? You thought that
yes.
we had that type of relationship?
That you could talk about things.
Oh, no. Oh,
sorry.
We don't, like... That's really interesting to
now
hear,
we do.
I guess.
We hang out a lot. We
yeah.
have more, I think.
Yeah.
It's closer now. So back then, you didn't feel comfortable?
No. So, like, there wasn't really, like, a way to talk about it, I guess.
Yeah.
Plus, it was, like, you were going through stuff, and I didn't want to, like, bother you with anything.
Thank you.
Yeah.
In the end, that wasn't a good decision.
Yeah, I know.
Her father took her to the hospital, and the hospital cleaned up her cuts and let her go home. Soon after, she was put on medication again. This was what she longed for since she was taken off. That made her feel like adults did take her more seriously. By the end of ninth grade, Sam had recovered enough to get off of her depression medication. She is a senior now and is doing great. When I go to her house, I often see her and her dad together, sitting on the porch, talking.
There was a famous phrase that we used in the house, which was, have I told you how much I loved you today?
Still the same old, have I told you how much I love you today?
Yeah, but I really mean it.
I know.
Sam believes we need to have a conversation to help people be less afraid of mental health issues.
By talking about it more, it becomes easier to talk about. I feel like it just will help other people like understand that, oh, a lot of people are experiencing this. This is kind of an issue. Let's talk about it. Plus, like, somebody has to talk about it. So, like, I'll talk about it.
And now, Sam's been heard. From Radioactive, Natalie Newcomb.
Radioactive is KUOW's terrific youth media program. Find us on Facebook at Radioactive Youth Media. Thanks for joining us here on KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Pokemon Go is the big game of the summer, sending players into the streets with phones trying to catch every screen creature. Well, some local towns have been doing a more natural version, painting rocks and hiding them to be caught. There is a nod to the screen. Each rock has got a Facebook link so you can upload photos of your discovery. Mercer Island resident Richard Ronald got into it on a summer outing.
We came across this on a family vacation to Whidbey Island. And my son happened to look down and see this brightly colored rock, picks it up. He's, of course, thrilled. We turn it over, and on the back, there were instructions that said, post a pic to Whidbey Island Rocks group page, and then hide or keep this rock. And he could not have been more tickled with having ferreted this out from its little hiding place. So we return home, and my daughter as well, who was she's a huge backer of this, and she said it made her summer. So we get home and we hunt down some unpainted rocks in the wild. You can find them out there.
You can find rocks in the wild.
Yes,
huh?
And they're free.
Amazing.
For the most part. Clean them off. We painted them up. Flipped them over. Post a picture to Mercer Island Rocks Facebook page. Hide or rekeep. And painted a few of those and realized we weren't going to have enough to get this off the ground. If it's one crazy family planting a dozen rocks, it's a little odd. So we enlisted the help of four or five of their friends. We had the inaugural Mercer Island Rocks sleepover party, and we must have painted 100 rocks that night and hopped in a couple of cars, drove them around the island at 10:30 at night, little SWAT teams of 10-year-old girls jumping out, running through parks, finding the best hiding spaces for them. We spent about 30 minutes seeding the north side of Mercer Island with the rocks and then just sat back and crossed our fingers watched our Facebook page to see what happened. And it was remarkable. We got responses very quickly.
What's painted and written on these rocks?
Oh, would you like to see one?
You brought a tin.
I brought a tin of these. Here we go. Hand them over to you. And again, I urge folks to just check out one of the Facebook pages to see what these beautiful things look like.
This is kind of a midnight scene to me.
Yo,
looks like the stars.
And if you flip these over, and what I find is observing folks who actually, one of these will catch their eye and they'll look down and they hesitate to pick it up because they don't know, what do you do with something like that? Am I allowed to pick this up? Should I investigate further? So half the time folks walk by. So if you see one of these works of art sort of staring out at you from, you know, a public art statue or that's on a park bench, grab it, pick it up, turn it over, see if it's one of these, if it's participating in this, if it's one of these creations.
I know what you mean, because you're not supposed to pick up public art. But here's this octopus that you can pick up and turn over.
If you read the back, it should say something like...
This one says, Whidbey Island Rocks, Facebook, take, pick, post, keep, or hide.
Yeah, there you are. So fairly simple instructions, and which means anyone can participate. So parents are painting these with their kids. We've got painting parties that are going on. It just is a real great way to have some together time. You know, at first I was enthusiastic about Pokemon Go. It gets people out into the community. But over time, rather than taking screens out into nature, it seemed like now they were processing nature through a screen. So it's the screenification of the non-screen world. This has that hunter-gatherer sort of push behind it in a similar way, but is again, it's completely community-based. And so you're actually generating real connections with your community and with people rather than swiping and grabbing something on the screen.
Are there rules that go with this rock painting? What you can and can't depict or say on the rock?
That's a fantastic question. And again, because it is community-driven, there's no central governance here or authority other than the community. You can be cheeky and irreverent. I think there were several poo emojis painted at that inaugural sleepover.
I'm sorry, poo emojis?
Some of your listeners will know what that is.
I know what poo is, and I know what emojis are.
There you go, then you've got it.
Okay.
It is an emoji that looks like poo.
Okay.
And they were hidden in park restrooms around the island as a sort of a wink.
Got it. You learned of this rock project on Whidbey Island. You're into it on Mercer Island. Is this going to fly in gritty urban Seattle?
I hope so. I think it could. And if for anyone out there listening, I think it's worth taking a shot to see. You can't know ahead of time how your community will respond. I do think it is a project that requires a self-defined community so that you do have a bit of a label for it or a bit of a boundary, some demarcation. So Seattle rocks, maybe not, but, you know, Capitol Hill rocks, probably so. And I think that's part of why people respond to this so well is it does help to it specifically calls out the community as part of the activity. And again, I think that that's something that people are really craving at the moment.
Richard Ronald created the Mercer Island Rocks Facebook page. We'll tweet out a link now to photos, including Halloween-themed rocks. Follow us at KUOW. You're listening to The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In the news today, Donald Trump's campaign released a letter from his doctor about his latest physical. It lists his weight, cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, other numbers, and concludes that Trump is in excellent physical health. Now, this is Trump's longtime doctor, Harold Bornstein. This letter is more detailed than the one Bornstein released before that was mainly platitudes. Also today, Trump was on the popular Dr. Oz medical TV show with the host asking him about his exercise regimen.
How do you stay healthy on a campaign trail?
Well, it's a lot of work. You know, when I'm speaking in front of 15 and 20,000 people and I'm up there using a lot of motion, I guess in its own way, it's a pretty healthy act. And I really enjoy doing it. A lot of times these rooms are very hot, like saunas. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's a form of exercise.
So much motion. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton returns to the campaign trail today after being sidelined by pneumonia. Clinton released a letter from her doctor yesterday declaring her fit to serve as president. We'll have the whole story and more this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. In Pendleton, Oregon, a Western pageant called Happy Canyon has kicked off its 100th year run. The Pendleton Roundup includes hundreds of volunteer performers, galloping horses, a live orchestra, Old West cowboy antics, and real Native Americans. But as correspondent Anna King reports, the 100-year-old show also includes some stereotypes.
Linda Jones is a member of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Reservation. She plays a native berry picker in the first act of Happy Canyon. It's about tribal life before Lewis and Clark and the Oregon Trail. Her role in the play is traditional, handed down from her aunt. But her favorite part is when her role ends. The Native Americans are depicted as leaving to be put on the reservation, the vanishing.
That's a kind of a sad moment, the vanishing. The vanishing is your favorite moment?
Yeah. Sounds kind of different. And it's surprising how many of us are like, oh, thank goodness we're finally done. You know, it's comments like that that we're making to each other.
Jones hasn't seen the second act. That's when the tone of the pageant dramatically flips. Rocks and cliffs become an old town site, and vaudevillian Western chaos springs forth. Some of it is just good fun. There's a runaway marching band, shootouts, and a fire in the brothel. But there are some cringy moments, too, like when two white teenagers play Chinese men in pointy hats.
I told you what I did to your chicken. If you
no!
They creep through the town like cartoons, begging for money.
Throughout the play, there are some very strong stereotypes that I think to an outsider would be very discomforting.
That's Catherine Brown, the publisher of Pendleton's East Oregonian newspaper. Chinese workers came to Pendleton to work on the railroad in the late 1800s and early 1900s. They were literally forced underground.
There were Chinese men working underground in Pendleton in the laundries.
And running other underground businesses like cardrooms and bordellos. They're begging in the play as one of the many stereotypes of the Old West. So is a white girl taken hostage by a Native American war party at the end of the first act. She is eventually freed by cowboys, and they jump to safety over a waterfall in an actual water-filled pool. There were real battles between the tribes and white settlers in this area. Some Native people who live nearby find the way it's portrayed in Happy Canyon harmful and racist. They're not even comfortable saying that on the radio, though. The town is small, and the play has run for 100 years. Still, others like berry picker Linda Jones keep participating year after year. She even camps in a teepee outside the rodeo stadium. And white people ask, can we see inside? She says, sure.
So then I'll show them our what we call our kitchen tent. And it just makes some of them just laugh out loud because, oh, you got all the comforts of home. You got a table with chairs and a stove and a two burner.
A shared moment of two peoples living side by side, like two acts of the same play. I'm Anna King in Pendleton, Oregon.
100 years have come and gone since 1849, but the ghostly wagons rolling west are ever brought to mind.
This story was a collaboration with the East Oregonian newspaper. We have a link to their photos and an interactive timeline at KUOW.org.
It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You go into a supermarket, almost any place in the world, and the chances are good you'll find an apple grown here in Washington State. How did we become the kings of apple growing? Well, food anthropologist Julia Harrison says it may have started with a cross-continental love story. A young British man travels to Fort Vancouver along the Columbia River.
around 1826 or 1827, there was this young man who was sent over from London on a tour of inspection. And the idea was that, you know, he would come to the fort and report back about what was going on there. And at his going away party in London, this is where the story gets kind of romantic and you can kind of, you know, play your violins in the background. There was a young woman and she was flirting with this guy. And over they were having apples for dessert, which is a fairly common thing in that time, that you would have the sweetest, best apples and you would sort of slice them up with your lovely silver service and eat them as dessert. So she removed the seeds from her dessert apple and wrapped them up in paper and gave them to this young man as a souvenir, as something to remember her by when he got to the New World. So he got to the fort, and you can imagine the difference between, you know, London high society and this log fort in the middle of the territory. And he discovered this packet of seeds, and he gave them to the people at the fort, and they actually grew them. So those trees eventually were sturdy enough to be transplanted outside, and they were put into the ground outside the gates of Fort Vancouver. And from what I've read, I think something like 4 to 6 of the trees survived. And there is still one of them that's living. And it is known very imaginatively as the old apple tree, right?
That's great. You got that from an airport novel.
Oh, I really should have. Like, it's so great.
That's,
I think, you know, it would make such a wonderful, like, Hallmark, you know, after school special kind of thing. So that tree now is still there. You can still visit it. It's not looking particularly good. It survived all sorts of threats. I-5 is actually right behind it. And the original drawings for I-5 would have called for the removal of this
tree. Of the old apple tree?
But there was this outcry. The tree was saved. And I-5 was actually bent to go around it.
Why do apples grow so well in Washington State?
There's a variety of reasons. So definitely in different parts of the state, either different kind of apples grow well or there is different capacity for production. To the east of the Cascades, what people found was really some of the best potential commercial apple growing land anywhere in the country. And so a huge part of that is the soil. So we come from this volcanic region. We have that sort of backbone of volcanoes up and down the state. And that interspersed a lot of ash in the soil. So the soil is very rich in these particular types of mineral nutrition that apples really thrive on. It tends to drain really well, which is also helpful. And then depending on the part of the state, on the contours of the land and the altitude, you also get this wonderful temperature range between very, very hot, clear days in the summer and then much colder nights. So that's what you need for the apples to not only grow, but to develop the complex sugars inside them and to change the color of the apple, because I'm sure you've watched apples develop and seen how the color of the skin changes. So if you didn't have that contrast, you wouldn't have that full development that you really need to have a good eating out of hand apple.
It sounds like we have the perfect natural climate for apples.
Yeah.
But we also, something happened with our business climate because this turned into a mega industry.
True.
What happened?
Well, there's been a couple of waves of big events. The first one was probably the involvement of the railroad. So the first rail line went into North Yakima in about 1885. And from that point on, the railroad had to concentrate on trying to get a return on that enormous investment. So one of the things that the railroads would do that I kind of love to imagine, again, this is another good Hallmark special, they would send agents into places, ports of entry like Seattle or Tacoma, places where, you know, there were young men flooding in from all over the world who were trying to look for better economic opportunities. And these agents would go up to a likely looking young man and say, like, you know, you look like you know a good thing when you hear it. And they would essentially offer them a free trip out to Yakima on this new railroad line on the condition that they would just look at some of this orchard land. So this is just textbook exactly like, you know, a timeshare lure, right? Come to Florida and check out this property, no strings attached. So, and this actually worked.
We just want you to listen to a talk.
Just a sales pitch. Yeah, have a cup of coffee. So one guy that this worked on was a Swedish migrant named Alfred Johnson. And Alfred Johnson migrated to this area in around 1901. And he went out to Yakima and liked what he saw. And so he purchased this orchard land from the railroads. And his family business is still there. And it's this wonderful kind of time travel-y oasis of trees. And, you know, it's still in the same place, but the city of Yakima has kind of swollen around it, or like a lava flow. And they're now in, I believe, at least their fourth generation of family ownership. Somebody told me that recently they were actually transitioning to their fifth generation. And they are still able to pick some fruit off of trees that were planted by Alfred Johnson himself.
A lot of time has passed since the early railroad days. Yeah. And there are other places that could grow apples. Why has Washington State been almost dominant in American apples since, you know, for a long time since those early railroad days?
Well, I think we successfully staked our claim on consumers' imaginations and tastes pretty early on. So another sort of strange icon of the early days was the apple crate and the apple crate label. And that developed around the 1890s in the Columbia River. So, you know, before that, when you were just maybe selling apples to your neighbors or somebody across town, you could just put them in, you know, a gunny sack or a basket or whatever you happen to have around. But when you start talking about transporting fruit in large volumes and long distances, you want to have something that's very sturdy and regular to hold them in. And so they began to use these pine crates. And then once you get these pine crates all the way to the East Coast, who wants to open every single one of them to see what's inside? So you slap a label on the outside of it. And the labels started to get more and more elaborate and also more kind of poetic. So, you know, some of them are a little cartoonish, but a lot of them have these really powerful and evocative images of the cultures of the Pacific Northwest, the natural beauty, the sort of athleticism and exoticism of this part of the world that a lot of people weren't able to experience directly, but they could get this taste of it through both the apples and these apple labels. And I think that that really did help to capture market share, but also kind of, you know, stamp people's kind of imaginations with our area.
I know we sell a lot of apples here. Mm-hmm. I see them in the grocery store. I think, oh, wonder why are we Apple Land? That's about as far as I've taken it. You have gone deep into Washington State apples. And what has that changed you somehow, that knowledge you have?
Yeah, I think it has certainly changed my approach to buying food, gleaning food.
Gleaning.
Talking to people about food. You know, a starting point for me for this research was looking out at this apple tree that was growing in the front yard of the apartment building where I live. And just thinking, like, I've lived here for, you know, at that point, probably 5 or 6 years. I've never tried an apple off of that tree. Like, why have I never done that? Why do I go to the store and buy all of these apples? And, you know, of course, the question is much more complicated than me just being, you know, brainwashed by the military food production complex. The apples that are growing in that tree are not particularly edible because they are, I think, originally a variety that was grown for cider production. So not something that you want to just go and pick and eat. So what I think that the apple has done for me has really given me a different sense of what is nature and what our interventions into the natural world have been, and to kind of think about the consequences of those, both good and bad. And it's also given me this sense that the world that I live in is essentially a document that we are all editing together. And every time I see a fruit tree or an apple tree, it is one of those little like green marks that comes up in Google Docs that shows you that someone else has edited what you're seeing. So, you know, in my weird neighborhood of all these, you know, kind of jumbled together apartment buildings, that apple tree is a reminder of a way of life that is not there anymore. And it's a reminder of somebody else's goals and hopes for the landscape around them.
Julia Harrison is a food anthropologist. She's been looking into the history of Washington State apples. Harrison is traveling across the state, sharing her tales of apples, of part of Humanities Washington's Speakers Bureau program. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9, Seattle News and Information. In environmental news today, Washington State has adopted a new rule to limit greenhouse gas emissions from big polluters. This morning, state environmental regulators finalized a rule requiring large industrial emitters to gradually reduce their carbon emissions. This would cover power plants, oil refineries, fuel distributors, pulp mills, paper mills, and others. You can learn more about this rule and a proposed Washington State carbon tax on the ballot this fall. You can find all of that at earthfix.info. Thanks for tuning in to The Record today. And if you missed any of it, remember, you didn't miss it because you can get our podcast at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.